from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here is Professor Stu Friedman.
Welcome to Work and Life on SiriusXM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I am your host, Stu Friedman, and I'm an organizational psychologist here at Wharton. I started the Wharton Work-Life Integration Project way back in 1991, and you can Google Wharton Work-Life and check out all the great resources, articles, our timeline, social impact, teaching, practical work that we do to find out more about the Work-Life Integration Project. But tonight, I am thrilled to be joined by Swarthmore Professor of Psychology, the great and much esteemed Barry Schwartz. He is a renowned scholar in the field of psychology of work, and we're going to be talking about his fantastic new book, which you must get. It's called Why We Work. Plus, later on, I'll be joined by Keith Persky, who is the Executive Managing Director of Workplace Innovation at Colliers International. We're going to be talking about Colliers' recent survey of employee wellness programs. What we do on this show is bring you everything related to work and the rest of your life. That's your family or your home, your community, and our society. And then there's your private self, your mind, body, and spirit. What we're trying to do is to help you to become more informed and ultimately more effective in creating a greater sense of harmony among these different parts of your life. And we come to you live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern time from the beautiful campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and it is absolutely stunning here right now as we are in the midst of a gorgeous fall. And we'd love to hear from you, so please write. You can get me at Twitter, at Stu Friedman, S-T-E-W-F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. You can also follow our channel's handle, where there's always something cool popping. It's at BizRadio 111. That's B-I-Z Radio 111. And you can write by regular old email, businessradio at SiriusXM.com. All right. I am really excited to be joined right now by my first guest. It's Barry Schwartz, who is a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College, where he's been since he got his PhD there way back in 1971. Well, sorry, he got his PhD from here at the University of Pennsylvania in 1971. Sorry for that error. He is the author of 10 books, hundreds of articles, and is really well known for both his scholarship as well as his ability to bring complex psychological and sociological research to bear on very practical matters that we all face in our daily lives at work and at home. That's why you're going to want to stay with us and be a part of this conversation. His most recent book, which we're going to be talking about right now, is called Why We Work. He's also written at least two other really important books. The ones that I want to point your attention to are The Paradox of Choice, Why Less is More, named one of the top business books of the year by both Business Week and Forbes, and co-authored with Ken Sharp, a great book called Practical Wisdom, about which he gave a TED Talk that's been viewed by more than 2 million people. Barry Schwartz, welcome to Work and Life.
Well, thank you so much, Stu. I'm afraid I can't live up to that introduction.
Ah. Hogwash. Of course you will. Oh, man. This great new book of yours is something that I know a lot of our listeners are going to be interested in. It's called Why We Work, and you obviously dig into the question of why indeed do we work? So give us the brief synopsis of how you got into this piece and what was like the primary discovery when you sought to answer this question.
Well, so this question has a long history with me. I was trained in the psychology of B.F. Skinner. Your listeners may not even know who that is anymore. But
well,
he was,
I have to say I met B.F. Skinner.
Well, I had an office down the hall from him for a year.
Amazing. So B.F. Skinner.
He was a dominant psychologist from the 40s to roughly 1970, invented the so-called Skinner box. And his view was that if you understood how rewards and punishments work, mm-hmm. you'd understand everything. And this is especially true of human beings. So the answer for him to the question why we work is the rewards and punishments. And, I thought this was a way too limited and reductive view. It didn't seem to describe me or most of the people I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it seemed pretty much to characterize the way workplaces were organized. And I started talking to a couple of philosophers at Swarthmore soon after I arrived, and they got me to read people like Adam Smith. I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't read him before. And, you know, Smith, the father of classical economics, had essentially the same view. You know, he said people are basically lazy. They'd rather be doing nothing than something. So to get them to do something productive, you have to make it worth their while, and that means you got to pay them. And once you pay them, it doesn't much matter what you have them do because they won't like it anyway, no matter what it is, and they're working for pay. So the assembly line, his famous pin factory, where you take something that's pretty simple to begin with, and then you make it even simpler by dividing it up into 6 or 7 or 10 different components to make straight pins, you know, that's his model of efficient production. And you ask, well, would anyone like to be just putting heads on pins 8 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week? And his answer would be, of course not. But it doesn't matter.
Because we are machines,
or
extensions
machines,
of machines, right?
As long as we're getting paid, we'll do whatever we have to do to get paid.
So the metaphor of the worker was as an extension of the machine.
Absolutely. And then, in the, you know, 100 years later, there was this movement called the scientific management movement that really tried to take the metaphor seriously by doing these meticulous time and motion studies so that you could create assembly lines where people expended the least possible effort and produce the fastest possible production. And again, and they also experimented with different ways of paying people to see how what kind of pay schedule would get people to work the hardest, the longest. So this was the answer to the question why we work was people work for pay, full stop.
That's the economic model.
That's the economic
purely
model,
economic
and
model.
It's the industrial model. You know, I think that economists, when they wrote in this way, never really believed that it was true because they didn't think it was true of them. So, you know, there's a kind of there's us and there's them. There are the people who wear white shirts and ties, and there are the people who wear blue shirts and work boots. And for us, other things matter, but us is just a small fraction of the population. And for them, everybody else, it's just about the paycheck. You know, I think I know this is an inaccurate depiction of work, but I think what's really important is that if you create workplaces in the image of this model, it will become true. Because if the only work available to you is soul-deadening, repetitive, mechanical work, then indeed you will work for the paycheck and nothing more, because there isn't anything more to be gotten.
And so your soul is indeed deadened and crushed,
so create,
and you might rebel.
You might rebel, but you know you got to put food on the table. You got to have a roof over your head. So you know, in effect, we started with a false understanding about what people care about, and we made it true by creating work structures that were consistent with that false understanding. And this is what I call ideology, which is a term that Karl Marx used to describe false ideas about human beings that become true when they get institutionalized. And you can see this happening, you know, with schools. Everyone is wringing their hands about how bad the public school system is. But increasingly, the attitude toward teachers, which is only being resisted because the teachers won't stand for it, is that they're basically cogs in a machine. You give them scripts, detailed lesson plans, and then you make their pay and bonuses and tenure contingent on how well kids do on standardized tests. And what happens when you do that is the good teachers leave, and the not-so-good teachers never have any occasion to get any better. And then they start cheating, right? They teach to the test or they change answers. So test scores go up, but kids don't learn any more than they did before. So it's not just, you know, blue-collar factory workers. This is really spread throughout, I think, the workplace.
As a model for how we organize work. And, of course, it's very destructive.
It's very destructive. Doctors are incredibly unhappy with the way they practice. It's becoming a national problem. They're leaving the profession. They're clinically depressed. Lawyers have been the unhappiest profession for years. And I think it's because we've basically sapped work of anything that people might aspire to, aside from a paycheck. And if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you're getting a big paycheck, but that just it doesn't cut it.
So back in the 60s and 70s, there was a humanist revolution of sorts that tried to counteract the destructive powers of this ideology and to create a new way of thinking about work, which I studied at the University of Michigan in the early 80s. But in the 70s, at the University of Michigan, there was it was really one of the centers of this social movement to reimagine work as something that could be ennobling and enriching of the spirit and to create a sense of meaning, purpose, and real consequence. And it seems to me that your work comes out of that tradition, which hasn't really taken as hold in the way that we would have hoped, I think, back in those halcyon days.
There aren't any ideas in my book that have not been articulated periodically before. You picked one time, but there are other times even earlier on where people acknowledge this. But somehow it never sticks.
But maybe now the time is different. Maybe
I'm
the time...
hoping it is for a couple of reasons.
Yes.
One is that there's research indicating that women care more about meaning and purpose in work than men do. And as more and more women enter the workforce and companies have a higher and higher proportion of employees who are women, managers may find that they won't be able to keep good employees unless they give the people working there some sense that they're working for a purpose.
One of the things we found, we just published a study a couple of years ago comparing the class of 1992 with the class of 2012 at Wharton, and it was a longitudinal study. So we asked hundreds of questions of the class of 1992 when they graduated and did the same in 2012. So we have a true cross-generational longitudinal design. And one of the important findings in the study was how the need for having a positive social impact through your work has grown for both men and women, but especially for women.
The second thing, and that is the millennial. The aspirations of millennials, at least while they're young, are quite different from what has preceded.
Yes.
So I just think that if you run a business and you want to attract talent, women and young people, you're going to have to show them that at the end of each workday, they've made the world better in some small way. So I'm somewhat optimistic. Mm. And then as these young people move up the organization, they may actually transform. When they're in positions of leadership, they may transform the organization.
I have the same hope and expectation. So how does what you write about in Why We Work help us to understand this movement and what people can do to advance it?
Well, I do a couple of things. One is I try to talk about what things do matter to people aside from a paycheck. They want some control over what they do, some autonomy. They want some variety in what they do. They want to be challenged. They want a sense that they're growing, that they're learning on the job. And most important, they want social engagement with coworkers and respect from supervisors and coworkers. And most important, they want this sense of meaning, that there's a point to what they do aside from simply paying their rent. So we know what you need to what you need to add to a workplace in order for people to get real satisfaction. And I also show in the book that workplaces that are structured in this way are the most profitable workplaces in their industry a wide variety of industries, which makes it even more puzzling.
Hang on to that thought. I want to let our listeners know I'm speaking with Swarthmore professor Barry Schwartz about his great new book, Why We Work. Barry, you were just saying how organizations that are able to organize work in such a way that individuals in them feel a sense of meaning and purpose through their work, positive social impact, that they do better?
Yes.
So tell us about that evidence.
Well, there's a management researcher named Jeff Pfeffer at Stanford.
He was on the show last week.
How about that? Well, this is an older book of his. He has a new one, I gather.
Yes, Leadership BS.
This is a book called, what's it called? The Human Equation.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does is he reviews evidence from banking and other kinds of financial industry, manufacturing, across a lot of service industry, and shows in every case that the most profitable companies are the ones that have the most enlightened management practices. The most profitable companies are the ones that invest the most time in training and personnel development and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you might argue that work ought to be organized in this way as a social good, because why should people spend half their waking lives doing something they hate when they don't have to? But then the boss would say, well, that's not my problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to make a profit. So then you turn around and you say, well, it turns out that here's a case where you do well by doing good.
So why don't we see this more widespread?
That's the total mystery, right? Why are all these companies leaving money on the table? And the only answer I can come up with to that is that the grip of this ideology about why people work, you know, the implicit answer that everyone has to my question just closes them off to the possibility that if they had a richer if they gave their employees more credit, the employees would be happier, the employees would do better work, and the company would be more profitable.
Credit, you say? Credit for having the motivation?
Credit for being responsible, serious people who want to do a good job. You know, a lot of the reliance on micromanagement and incentives is a reflection of a lack of trust.
Of course.
You know, if I don't manage the hell out of them, they'll just sit around doing nothing. They'll take advantage of me. So, you know, that's how do you combat that? You combat that by making it so that if they do take advantage of you, you see it and they suffer.
Yes.
So if you trusted your employees, you know, you give them the goal and you trust that they'll figure out the way to achieve the goal. Or you give them the training so that they're eventually in a position to figure out how to achieve the goal instead of giving them recipes.
Instead of micromanaging and telling...
You know, the trouble is that with all this technology we've got now, mm-hmm. the level of micromanagement that's possible is just overwhelming. You don't even need to be standing there and looking over your employee's shoulder. You can measure a million things.
Yes. Big data can be intrusive.
The duration of every call in the call center.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools for micromanagement are there, and I'm afraid that, you know, managers can't resist the temptation to use them.
Because it gives at least the illusion of greater control, if not the fact of greater control. But that might squeeze out all the human capacity for creative and ingenious effort that would produce great results.
Absolutely. They have more control, mm-hmm. but they get worse work.
Yes, this is the great dilemma.
That, by the way, I think raises another possible explanation,
mm-hmm.
which is that managers hate the thought of giving up control.
Well, some do.
And
why is that? What is the fear there? What's the anxiety about giving up control and unleashing the human potential that's there?
Well, if you do that, what role do you play? You still need it?
Well,
people can manage themselves.
You're perhaps needed to do something different, which
maybe.
Is to guide and to help to manage external connections and help to provide a sense of direction by having a bigger picture, right?
It's true, but there are an awful lot of people whose job is to make sure that an awful lot more
mm-hmm.
people are just doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you had other ways of assuring that people would be doing their jobs, these people would have no role to play.
So do you see the elimination of the middle management ranks in the offing as people become more empowered, perhaps through big data, to be able to manage themselves?
Well, it's not out of the question that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But all I'm suggesting is that it may actually be a source of one source of the resistance.
Yes.
To, you know, the evidence that I regard as plain and unambiguous.
Amazing. So one of the things that we like to talk about on this show, of course, is the connection between work and other parts of life. I wonder what your thoughts are about thinking about the connection between greater sense of meaning and purpose that is plainly available, if not difficult to implement for so many different kinds of organizations. What impact that has and could have on employees' lives beyond work, in their families, communities, and for themselves personally?
Well, you know, I suppose you'd actually need to collect data on this, and I haven't, but what I suspect is If you do work that you value, you will be happy at work.
Mm-hmm.
If you're happy at work, your relations with other people will go better. When you come home at the end of the workday, your puss won't be sour, your patience won't be strained, you'll be in a good mood more of the time, and the result is that your spouse and your kids will actually find it tolerable to be with you.
Well, they might even enjoy it. And this
they
is,
might even enjoy it. That, I mean, let's not get carried away.
No. We should get carried away because the research does support that. It's called positive spillover, right?
Uh-huh.
When you feel good in one part of your life, and it's likely to spill over both in terms of your emotional state as well as the kind of behavior you demonstrate in the other roles that you play.
And we also have evidence, Barbara Fredrickson has provided this, that people who experience positive affect are more creative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the workplace, the advantage of that is obvious. I haven't thought much about the potential advantages of this, you know, when you come home at the end of the workday, but it seems to me quite possible that being more creative means the problems that we inevitably face in managing our, rebellious adolescent kids are, you know, we find that we have an easier time solving those problems if we can think about them more openly and creatively,
mm-hmm.
which we might well do if we come home from work, you know, sort of feeling good about ourselves instead of feeling, down, depressed,
depleted.
And miserable.
Yeah. So there are so many benefits to this. Now, if you're,
there is one potential drawback that's worth mentioning. I think this is a very small price to pay. There are some people who like the idea that when the workday is over, they leave their work and they come home. So, you know, they are okay with the idea that work is just for making a living, and they're human in the rest of their life. And they don't want to have to come home at the end of the day with work still on their mind.
The so-called segmenters.
The problem is if you're really engaged with your work, then you're not going to stop thinking about it when it gets to be 5 o'clock. So you may be a little bit distracted when you're interacting. So, and, you know, could that happen? Of course it can happen. It certainly happened to me often enough in the mm-hmm. course of my career.
When
my kids would ask me something, I'm looking right at them, and I'm not hearing a word that they say.
I know exactly what you mean, Barry. It's happened to me as well, and I study this whole issue of boundaries, the psychological and the physical boundaries that you need to be able to switch gears and attend to the people around you,
so
even though your mind is elsewhere.
I could see people paying a small price in that way.
And further, that it's possible to learn how to control your attention if you really are focused on it and to maintain, you know, a focus on the people who are right in front of you when they need you.
Those are
learnable skills. So in Why We Work, what are the implications of your analysis for what we're seeing in this presidential election season, which, yes, it has begun. Of course, it seems to last forever. But, the whole question of the economic divide, which has become such a pronounced issue in our society and in these debates, what you've been in this field now for quite a while. As you look back retrospectively over the course of your career in psychology and thinking about work, what is different now? Aside from what you were saying earlier about millennials, what else do you see?
The political debate is really quite disappointing because I think I understand why, but because of the hollowing out of the middle class, mm-hmm. all of the discussion, 100% of the discussion, is about compensation, job security, and benefits. No one is talking about the character of the work itself. It's all about, except the work has to be good enough that you can actually get a decent paycheck.
Mm.
So
all
if you could find some way to get a decent paycheck to people working at McDonald's, that would be fine. And I think maybe that when times are hard and there does seem to be pressure to fatten the pay envelope, the kinds of things I'm worried about just recede into invisibility. And you need people to be flush for this to become an actual agenda item on somebody's political platform. Maybe I've missed it. Have you heard anyone talking about the question of what it is that people do when they work?
Not so much as they have been, thankfully, I have to say, talking about the needs of working families to have support that they need through family medical leave and
a
national policy.
But again, it's all financial.
But that is, it's about time, but it's not about meaning.
It's about time, but the time, it's not just about time. It's not family leave. It's compensated family leave. You know, you can get some family leave.
Right.
Worse than any other developed country, but some of it is available. It's just not compensated.
Barry, we are nearing the end of our time together, I'm afraid. Let me ask you a final question then, and that is, what do you see unfolding? You see young people in class every day. What do you see unfolding if you were to look out, the next quarter century or so? What do you think you might see in terms of how work is going to look?
I'm optimistic because of the women and millennials that more and more workplaces will discover this not very hidden secret and give their employees a chance to find meaning and satisfaction at the same time that they get a paycheck. I'm hoping that by the time my grandchildren are entering the workforce, finding a wonderful job won't be like finding a needle in a haystack anymore.
I'm optimistic as well, and I thank you, Barry, for composing this great work that helps us all understand why we work and what it means for how we organize work in our society. Barry, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a great, you had great questions.
Thank you. I have been speaking with Swarthmore Professor of Psychology, Barry Schwartz. He's a renowned scholar in the field of psychology at work, and his great new book is Why We Work. Stay with us, because coming up, I'll be talking with Keith Persky, who is the Executive Managing Director of Workplace Innovation at Colliers International. We're going to be talking about their recent survey of employee wellness programs. I'm Stu Friedman, and you're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111.